a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
Tonight, the police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
We're taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep. And that's about it. And we went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while. And that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who was playing? That's what the whole thing is. That we were, all we was doing out there was playing. You know.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. Very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains and just like a deer. And he just wandered around.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our eighth look at Charles Manson and his family. Before we get going on this week's chapter, as always, I have the usual show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, YouTube, Truth Media, LinkedIn. Just search for either Ian Totten, author, Corpse Creek Publishing, or The Deathcast. I am on all of those sites, fairly interactive. If you would like to sign up for the show's mailing list and find out what's going on with new series that I am working on and various novels I have slated to release, go to CorpseCreepPublishing.com, click on the sign up button while you're there. If you enjoy what it is I do, please consider clicking on the donate button. No amount is too small, nor is any amount too large. It really does help and is appreciated. If you would like to sign up for the Deathcast official Patreon, go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a member and help with the production of this show, help offset the price of keeping all of our content online. If you can't afford to spare any shekels but still would like to help out with the show, please consider going to wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, subscribing, sharing the show on social media, and leaving a 5-star review. Every 5-star review helps, and they will be read out live on air. lastly, a quick shout out to my friend Deb over at True Crime University. If you're looking for more true crime to help fill out your week, she has an excellent podcast that you may enjoy. She has a background in law enforcement, really gets deep into the subjects that she's covering, specifically the psychology of the perpetrators. All right, now that that is all out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my smokes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we had been discussing the initial discovery of the bodies up at the Tate/Polanski home, as well as the investigation that ensued, some stories that have come out since then, as well as touching briefly on the idea that there may have been other reasons why Sharon Tate and her friends were targeted, namely drugs, as well as the falsified idea that Manson wanted to create a race war. We're going to shift gears at this point and take a look at the next series of murders, which took place on the morning of August 11th, 1969. That would be the murders of the LaBiancas. Quick background on the LaBianca family. Pasqualino Antonio Leno LaBianca was born August 6, 1925 in Los Angeles, California, the son of Italian immigrant parents. He was known by friends and family as Leno. His father, Antonio, owned two grocery stores, Gateway Ranch Markets and the State Wholesale Grocery Company. Leno was an exceptional student in high school, so much so that he eventually skipped a grade, going on eventually to enroll at the University of Southern California while taking up a position in his father's company, Gateway Ranch Markets. He was a veteran of World War II, heading to the European Theater in September of 1944, he returned home in March of 1946. Now, before leaving for the war, Leno ended up marrying his high school sweetheart, a woman by the name of Alice. And after returning from the war, Leno and Alice had their first child, a girl they named Corina Jane LaBianca, who was born in 1948. In 1951, he was elected to the board of directors and named vice president of both Gateway Markets and State Wholesale Grocery Company. Remember, this was his father's businesses. In December of 1951, the couple had another child, this one their first son, Anthony Carl LaBianca. Later on, Leno's father died, leaving the business to him, at which point Leno moved the family from where they were living to his parents' home on Waverly Drive in the Los Feliz district of Los Angeles. In January of 1955, Leno and Alice separated, with both party moves moving out of the Waverly Drive house. Interesting to note that in September of that year, despite being separated, Leno's wife gave birth to a third child by the name of Luis LaBianca. Later that year, although it is difficult to find out when exactly, they did end up getting divorced. The woman who would become his second wife, Rosemary LaBianca, as Ruth Catherine Elliott, on December 15th, 1929, in Arizona, Rosemary's parents ended up divorcing when she was still quite young, and she ended up going with her mother and brother, William, while her father took her two older sisters. This changed when it became apparent that Rosemary's mother would not be able to take care of all three of them, and Rosemary and her brother were placed into separate homes for adoption. At age 8, Rosemary was adopted by the Harmon family in Fullerton, California, whose own biological daughter had died previous. And this part is kind of creepy. The Harmon family renamed their 8-year-old daughter, Ruth, after their deceased child, Rosemary. Eventually, Rosemary married a man by the name of Frank Struthers in 1952, which produced two children, Susan and Frank Jr., although the couple would later divorce in 1956. While working at the Los Feliz Inn, Rosemary met Leno LaBianca in 1959. Prior to their meeting, Leno, who was running both of his father's companies, decided to sell off the wholesale market and instead focused all of his attention on gateway markets in an effort to expand them and turn them into a franchise. When he did meet Rosemary, he had graduated from the University of Southern California with a degree in finance. The two were married in Carmel, California in 1960. While this was going on, the couple focused on raising their children from the prior marriages and decided eventually to settle in the home that Leno had grown up with on Waverly Drive, which Leno bought from his mother in 1968. The LaBiancas began expressing concern to their friends in the summer and spring of 1969 as they noticed that upon returning home from being away, odd things had happened. There were items missing from the home and moved around. At one point, they discovered that their dogs had been put out back behind the home. Eventually, it was learned that the Manson family had creepy crawled their home as well as many others in the area. For those of you who have not listened to the entire series, the creepy crawling was when Manson and his followers would break into people's houses in the middle of the night and steal things or just walk around inside the house, see how long they could get away with it. Oftentimes they would stand there staring down at the individuals who owned the home while they slept in bed, with a number of occasions occurring where the individual woke up and saw the person staring at them or a group of individuals staring at them, only for the silent specters to flee before the homeowner could raise the alarm. By August of 1969, the LaBiancas were very well off, with Leno being valued at upwards of $2.5 million. Leno was 41 at this point, while Rosemary was 38, and it seems as though they were enjoying their life together. On August 5th, the two of them drove their speedboat from Los Angeles to Lake Isabella, where Rosemary's teenage son, Frank Struthers, was visiting family friends, the Safis. They left the boat at the lake with Frank and the family friends before returning to Los Angeles. On August 9th, Rosemary and Leno returned to the lake to retrieve the speedboat, as well as Frank, and they brought Rosemary's daughter, Suzanne, who was 21 at the time, along with them. They spent time with the son and Suzanne, intending to bring the boat and Frank back with them. However, at the last minute, Frank was asked to stay until Sunday, something that the LaBiancas allowed, and they left, driving their Camaro with speedboat in tow back to their home in Los Angeles. Along the way, they dropped Suzanne off at her house at roughly 1 a.m. Suzanne lived not very far from the house on Waverly Drive. Not long after this, the car that they were driving pulled up in front of a newsstand, and Leno brought a copy of the Herald Examiner and the National Daily Reporter, which was a horse betting publication. According to the proprietor of the newsstand, John Focianis, Rosemary remarked on how disturbing what had happened at the Cielo Drive home was, and he decided to give her the front page section from the Sunday Los Angeles Times, which had the headline that you can see online on the Deathcast Facebook page, leads off with the title of Ritualistic Murders. Afterwards, the couple drove back to their home, parking the car on the street near the house with the boat still attached to it. The Waverly Drive home, 3301, was a one-story affair in a fairly affluent neighborhood. One thing that should be pointed out is that some stories state that the home had belonged to Walt Disney at one point, while other sources state that the home that they had lived in prior to purchasing the Waverly Drive house from LaBianca's mother was in fact the home that Walt Disney had owned. They lived inside of this house with Rosemary's son, Frank. To the east of this home at 3267 Waverly Drive was a large home that had once been rented by an acquaintance of Manson during the period of September 1967 to September of 1968. And it is this home here that has been noted as being the reason that Manson knew the layout of the neighborhood, as he and many of his followers had spent time at this home, often imbibing on LSD. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, this home was directly next door to the LaBianca home. Also of interest, just prior to what is about to take place, the LaBiancas discovered that their phone had been tapped. They discovered this when they began having problems making and receiving phone calls and had a telephone repairman come out, at which point the repairman discovered the tap inside of the receiver. And it is thought that the phones had been tapped because Leno had a penchant for betting on horses. And according to Ed Sanders in his book, Sharon, A Life, it is thought that he was using a man who was known by the nom de plume of the Phantom, apparently a fairly infamous bookmaker in the Los Angeles area who lived not far from the LaBianca's home. Upon arriving home, the LaBiancas removed the water skis from inside of the boat, placing them next to Rosemary's 1955 Thunderbird, which was near the garage, at which point they went into the house and Rosemary placed her purse on top of the liquor cabinet in the dining room. Both of them prepared to go to bed, getting dressed in their pajamas, with Rosemary being inside of the bedroom and her husband in the living room reading his copy of the Herald Examiner sports section. At this point, he looked up and found that a short, hairy man wearing a black turtleneck sweater, jeans, and moccasins, waving a sword, was standing inside of his living room. Again, this is coming from Sharon, A Life by Ed Sanders. The reason I am using this is he is a very detail-oriented researcher, and he is extremely good at putting a timeline together as to what happened. According to Sanders, Manson said, quote, "Be calm, sit down, and be quiet." He also went up into the bedroom and fetched Mrs. LaBianca, bringing her back down to the living room, where he ordered them to stand back to back. Then, using two 42-inch strips of leather, he tied the two of them together with a square knot, at which point he sat them down onto the couch before walking over to the liquor cabinet and liberating Rosemary's wallet from her purse. Afterwards, he walked outside to a waiting 1959 Ford. This is the same car that had been used on the previous evening. Inside of this car were Tex Watson, Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Cromwinkel, Linda Kasabian. There are different versions of what exactly happened on this night, with some stating that Manson, Kasabian, Watson, and Van Houten and Susan Atkins originally went out, and that in fact it was Manson and Watson who went into the house. That Leno had told the men that his wife was upstairs, at which point Manson went upstairs and got Rosemary, allowing her to put a dress on before leaving that bedroom. They brought them downstairs, tied them up, and as Manson stole the money from the purse, Watson brought Rosemary back upstairs, placed a pillowcase over her head, and began choking her with an electric cord before telling her to remain calm and going back down to meet Charlie in the living room. In any event, what ended up happening was fairly horrific, as Manson left Tex, Leslie Van Houten, and Patricia Cromwinkel inside of the house, instructing them that the people inside were calm and that they had no fear of what was to come, that they were to go inside and murder them before hitchhiking back to Spa Ranch. This killing, as with the murders at Cielo Drive, was fairly brutal in that they immediately began to stab Leno with a bayonet. When I say they, I mean specifically Watson began to stab him. Again, there are so many different versions of what happened on this evening. I am going with the most straightforward of them. He begins to stab Leno with the bayonet. The man begins to cry out, begging him to stop stabbing, at which point Mrs. LaBianca, who is in the bedroom with the two girls, began screaming and thrashing about herself. Watson leaves Leno, who is bleeding profusely, including from one stab wound to the throat, in the living room, and goes back up to the bedroom to help Leslie and Patricia to subdue Mrs. LaBianca. Watson begins stabbing Mrs. LaBianca at this point before returning back downstairs and finishing off Leno. Afterwards, he carved the word war into the man's abdomen. Returning to the bedroom, Watson then found Patricia Cromwinkle stabbing Rosemary with a knife she had taken from the kitchen, followed not long after by Leslie Van Houten, who stabbed Mrs. LaBianca approximately 16 times in the back and rear end. We will get back to the horrificness of this in just a moment.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie, the name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
We are back. Later at her separate trial, Leslie Van Houten would claim that all of the stab wounds that she inflicted on Rosemary Bianca were done after the woman died, and this was actually borne out by the prosecution and the autopsy that showed that of the 41 stab wounds Rosemary LaBianca suffered, most of them occurred post-mortem. After this, the killers lounged around the house for a bit, with Watson going and taking a shower and cleaning off the bayonet, while Patricia Cromwinkle went around and wrote the words "Rise and Death to Pigs" on the walls, followed by the words "Helter Skelter" on the refrigerator door, all in Leno LaBianca's blood. Again, there are conflicting reports on what happened after this. Some have stated that Patricia Cromwinkle did what was done, while others state that it was in fact Leslie Van Houten, who Watson had felt had not been vicious enough in their attacks. In any result, Leonard's body was stabbed a total of 14 more times with a pair of two-tined carving fork. It's that kind, the fork you'd see someone using when they're on a grill and they're trying to flip a steak. So he was stabbed with this numerous times, with the last stab going into his stomach and the fork being left there. Afterwards, a steak knife was plunged into the man's throat. One of the killers took a thing of chocolate milk for the refrigerator, and some reports say that they actually had a meal inside of the house before fleeing into the night. Meanwhile, while all of this is going around, Manson and the others continue to drive around, eventually going to a home in Venice, California, which belonged to a Lebanese actor by the name of Saladin Nader. Manson left the three who were in the car. I believe this three was Clem Grogan, Linda Kasabian, and Susan Atkins. This is one of the bits of evidence that was later introduced in trial to try and show the evil nature of Susan Atkins. According to Linda Kasabian, Manson ordered them to murder the actor in a similar manner as had been done to both the LaBiancas and the Tate household. Kasabian claims that she was unable to do this and intentionally went to the wrong door and knocked on it, which woke up the owner of this home, at which point the three would-be killers took off, with Susan Atkins stopping while they fled to defecate in a stairwell and an apartment complex, at which point they too disappeared into the night. The following morning, August 10th, Rosemary LaBianca's son, Frank Struthers, was driven home in the evening, right around dusk, and dropped off in front of the house at 3301 Waverly Drive. Finding the car out in the driveway, along with the boat in the road, Frank also noticed that all of the shades were drawn inside of the house as he made his way up the driveway. Going around to the back of the house, Frank knocked on the door, and after receiving no answer and discovering that the water skis from the previous day were lying against the fender of his mother's car and that the door was locked, he then went and began rapping on windows, only to receive further silence. At this point, Frank went down the street to a payphone and called the house. Upon receiving no answer, he called his sister and informed her that he was worried. Susan and her fiancé, a man by the name of Joe Dorgan, arrived at the Waverly Drive home, where they met up with Frank. Searching the cars, they found the keys to the house in the ignition switch of Rosemary's Thunderbird and entered the home through the back door, with Susan staying in the kitchen while Frank and Joe made their way through the dining room and into the living room where they saw Leno in a quote-unquote crucified position on the floor. At this point, the young man and Joe Dorgan fled from the living room back into the kitchen. Joe, thinking to call the police, picked up the phone before fear overtook him, and the trio fled out into the yard, screaming for help. A neighbor, hearing this, placed a phone call to the police, and at roughly 10:45 p.m., cars arrived in the driveway. The house on Waverly Drive was very quickly beset by more police officers as well as reporters from the various local television stations and newspapers. Remember the Tate murders, which had just been discovered the previous morning, was still fresh on everyone's mind. But more so than that, newspapers and TV news crews know that blood sells. The Los Angeles Times would go on to put out a front page story that led off with the headline of "Two Ritual Slayings Follow Killing of Five." They linked these murders to to the ones at Cielo Drive. However, as we're going to see, it was a little bit of time before the police actually did this. Just as they had done on Cielo Drive, the police really didn't keep any holdback information concerning these murders, with newspapers and television reports going so far as to mention the knife and fork that were left protruding from Leno LaBianca's body, along with the words which had been written on the walls and the refrigerator and the body of Leonard. Also of note, the newspapers made mention of white hoods which were placed over their victims' heads. Reality, these were pillowcases that had been put over the victims' heads by Tex Watson in an effort to disorient them. A man by the name of Greg Jacobson was questioned almost immediately by the police, as he was known to both individuals on Waverly Drive as well as on Cielo Drive, although he was unable to give any hardcore information. It has been speculated, however, that had the police released the writing on the refrigerator, the words helter skelter misspelled, it is believed that Jacobson, as well as many others, would have been able to point police in the direction of the family at this period of time, although they did not release that information, only that words had been written on the refrigerator, and thus an opportunity to stop the killers before they could go and commit any further crimes was missed. The following day, August 11th, the caretaker of the Cielo Drive home, William Garretson, was released from police lockup where he had been held since the discovery of the bodies up at Cielo Drive. During a press conference that day, a police sergeant, who at this point remains unknown, told newspapers that there is, quote, a similarity between the two crime scenes, but whether it's the same suspect or a copycat, we just don't know. Numerous reasons have been given as to why the police did not initially link the two cases. The separate victims' lifestyles, their group of friends, where they lived within the city, along with the fact that, so far as the police could tell, there were no ties to connect the two murders, led them to mistakenly believe that the crimes were committed by separate groups. While the Tate murders were looking into the drug avenue of the crimes, as well as possibly former business partners or associates of Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski, the LaBianca investigation instead focused on Leno's business affairs as well as his gambling activities. It was learned that roughly $200,000 was missing from Gateway Markets. Also noted as missing was a collection of rare coins that belonged to Leno LaBianca. Later on, a rare coin collection was found in the home of the bookmaker on Waverly Drive, who Leno was known to have done business with. It should be noted, however, that many of those who knew the LaBiancas stated right out of the gate that there were no organized crime ties to their murders, and that the couple, while they like to flash their wealth somewhat, generally speaking, with the exception of Leno's gambling activities, stayed out of the type of thing which might bring couple to the attention of the local mafia. Inside of the home, 25 fingerprints were found, with 19 being eliminated almost immediately, leaving 6 that were unidentified at that period of time. And while there were very few suspects in the LaBianca murders, the Tate murders were another animal entirely. In fact, there were a slew of arrests following the discovery of Sharon Tate, J. Sebring et al. At the Cielo Drive house. Mostly, these were arrests for narcotics. The majority of the people who were arrested were thought to either have sold drugs to the inhabitants of the Cielo Drive home or have sold drugs for the people at the Cielo Drive home. And the police went so far down this avenue as to offer immunity from prosecution to certain individuals should they provide them with any information which might have led to the arrest of the murderer. To give you an idea of how much stock the police put into the idea that drugs were at the heart of the slayings at Cielo Drive, 3 detectives from Los Angeles County actually flew up to Vancouver to assist the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in a dragnet for drug smugglers whom they had been put onto by a house painter that was known to the inhabitants of the Cielo Drive home. It was thought that these individuals may have participated in or even ordered the murders. And at least according to Ed Sanders, in the days after the murders at Cielo Drive, there was an increase in cocaine trafficking arrests, which is thought to have resulted from the murder investigation of Sharon Tate and her friends. Last episode, we discussed somewhat briefly films that are purported to have been found inside the home on Cielo Drive. One of these was found in a room off of the living room loft and was booked in as evidentiary item number 36, while others were discovered in Jamaica and in Annandale, Virginia. According to numerous different reports, these films were part of a group that swapped films among each other in the Hollywood elite and involved stars, semi-stars, and other important individuals within the entertainment industry. One video that was supposedly of Sharon and Roman Polanski in the act of coitus was viewed by police before being returned to the residence at Cielo Drive, almost to the exact spot that it had been found in. And supposedly, these films were so scandalous that later on, a rising actress actually had her lawyers approach the defense team lawyers for Manson to find out as to whether or not they had removed a roll of 16mm film that starred this young woman in it from the Polanski house. However, I have been unable to find if, in fact, this was taken or the disposition of the film. So now we have the 2 murders at the core of our story, and from this point on, with the police looking into all these various avenues, things began to spread around Hollywood as to who could possibly have committed the crimes on Cielo Drive. There were stories that, in fact, the Polish secret police had traveled to Los Angeles via Rome and committed the murders as revenge for Polanski defecting from the his country. There were stories about the, you know, possibly police involvement in the murders for, you know, failing to play blackmail money to them after they had either discovered Sharon Tate on film engaging in sexual acts with people who were not her husband, or even that the police were protecting the drug dealers and that they had themselves had failed to pay this money, and as a result the police removed them in an effort to send a message to other drug dealers in the area who were paying off the police. There was also stories that Satanists had been involved, that it had been a mob hit. Any kind of wild speculation that you can think of to put on these kinds of murders was at one point bandied about by those living within Los Angeles. There were also those two who stated that the murders were not, in fact, you know, targeted, carried out, but were part of a bigger problem that was taking hold in Los Angeles, specifically from August 8th until August 12th, when 29 people were murdered. This had an effect on the population of Los Angeles, that gun sales went through the roof as people began to arm themselves in fear that, you know, something secretive and devious was taking place within the city and its environs, and that the spike in murders was going to continue. On Monday, August 11th, this is the day after the LaBiancas were found slain, Roman Polanski, who really had just arrived back in Los Angeles from London, agreed to take a lie detector test. Polanski passed the lie detector test, although it should be noted, it has been stated, he was under the effects of Valium at the time the test was administered. I honestly don't believe that has, you know, bearing on this case one way or the other. I really don't believe Polanski was involved in any way, shape, or form in the murder of his wife. During the interview with police and subsequent polygraph test, he was shown a number of photographs, only one of which, that of Billy Doyle, he was able to recognize. The police also showed him an array of knives. This, I would imagine, was an attempt to get him to recognize the murder weapon. Of note, during Polanski's lie detector test, he was asked, quote unquote, "Have you dated any airline stewardesses since Sharon's death?" To which Polanski replied, "Yes, well, I haven't dated. I've seen a couple of them." Question: took them out to lunch or something? Answer: I fucked them. Polanski later stated in court proceedings, when this bit of evidence was played inside of the courtroom, that this was in fact a boast of his, done to lessen the tension that he was feeling with the officer administering the lie detector test. He further went on to state, quote, "Not that I object to it, particularly in those times. It would be something I would not miss if I had the opportunity." The same day that Polanski was undergoing his polygraph test and gave these statements regarding stewardesses, two reporters from the New York Daily News, a man by the name of Michael McGovern and another man by the name of William Federici, met with an agent of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which is the precursor to the DEA. The agent gave the two reporters information that they would later use in a newspaper column from the Daily News dated August 13th. Basically, the agent told the reporters that he believed that there was a cult involvement inside of the murders. Later, when one of the reporters was asked how the BNDD would know anything about the crimes, he responded that, quote, "They were involved in this thing right from the beginning. The BNDD was part of the whole thing. That there was a whole task force." Basically, the gist of this story is that there was a sex/drug cult involved in the murders, and according to this agent, it was members of this sex/drug cult who were behind the murders themselves. The fact that the BNDD was involved at all with the investigation of the Tate murders speaks volumes to the fact that the police heavily believed that narcotics trafficking was at the heart of these murders. According to this report, quote, "Discovered in the death house was an assortment of the cult's tools, including black leather masks, whips, ropes, and chains. Outside in the driveway, in the trunk of Sebring's black 1966 Porsche was a quantity of cocaine, LSD, marijuana, and methadrine, known as speed." The article went on to state that the group was known as the Swingers and that this organization had about 50 members who were picked up at various clubs around New York by members of Sharon's entourage. On August 17th, another reporter stated in an article that, quote, "A day after Polanski arrived in Los Angeles International Airport, a source close to the investigation declared that there had been a wild party attended by some of the biggest freaks and weirdos in Hollywood. What's more, Prober said Sharon and the other four might have been victims of an assassin hired by a member of the cult that met regularly in the Polanski home for sex drug rituals." Ed Sanders claims that during 1970, when he was covering the trial for his book, which became the seminal work known as The Family, an individual from the Daily News filled him in on all of this information and informed him that black hoods had been found inside of the house, as well as some form of black aprons, which were shaped like a down-pointed ace of spades. There were stories also swirling around among various Hollywood elites that the victims at the Tate household were involved in a sadomasochistic club or cult, with one story stating that Sebring and Frykowski had been burned by a coke dealer for a large amount of money, and that in return, the two men had kidnapped the man, after which he was brought to Mama Cass Elliott's home, where in front of exactly 25 prominent rock and movie stars, he was stripped, whipped, and buggered, that is to say, anally raped. According to this particular line of thought, vengeance was extracted by this drug dealer who had been so humiliated. According to A.E. Hotchner, in a biography of Doris Day, Terry Melcher is supposed to have said, quote, "I hadn't been in the house since I moved out, but I had presumed that the murders had something to do with the weird films Polanski made and the equally weird people who were hanging around the house. I knew they had been making a lot of homemade sadomasochistic porno movies there with quite a few recognizable Hollywood faces in them." Although the source of this particular story, Michelle Phillips, who you'll see popping up in a lot of these kinds of stories from this period of time in Los Angeles, as well as her husband, John Phillips, both of the mamas and the papas, she has denied ever making this statement, or that Melcher ever said these things to her. So, we're going to leave the story here today. At this point, again, the police really have no motive, although they are heavily tracking down the idea that drugs were in some way involved in the murders. While the people within Hollywood, as they often do, were spreading fantastical tales involving sex and drugs and weird fetishes, which in our day and age might not seem so taboo, but back during 1969 were considered freakish and abnormal. There is some truth to all of this, obviously. We know that Frykowski and Folger were involved in trafficking drugs, just as we know that Roman Polanski, as well as his wife Sharon Tate, had extremely voracious sexual appetites, and that Jay Sebring was into BDSM. So I would imagine that most of these stories arose from known facts around Hollywood concerning the participants. And there's a very good chance that some of these participants told either police or reporters that they had heard this particular story from so-and-so, and there you go. Now it's in the newspapers or it's floating around Hollywood. It's like the old game of telephone where you tell one person at the beginning of the line that, you know, Sharon and Polanski didn't want to have children. And by the time you get to the end of it, they were involved in a wildly violent swinger cult who participated in BDSM and took human slaves from various clubs around Los Angeles. I guess what I'm getting at is, in all of these various stories, there is a little bit of fact mixed in with fiction, particularly when it comes to the idea that there were drug-fueled orgies up at the house at Cielo Drive and at other Hollywood residences, and that things such as films starring Sharon and numerous other partners were made. Until next week, I hope you have enjoyed this episode of the Deathcast. Again, please remember to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Leave a 5-star review. Share it on social media. Again, if you are interested in joining the Patreon page, simply go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. If you're interested in finding any of my novels, you can go to tinyurl.com/totten-books and sign up for the mailing list or drop me a line about anything you have thoughts on that I've covered in this show at CorpseCreekPublishing.com. Until next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.